First, I'd like to thank NIESH for taking the lead in organizing what I so far have found to be a very interesting meeting, the mixtures of people from different disciplines. I thought at this meeting I would talk about some of the work I've been doing that I think pushes our attempts to understand quantum gravity in a bit of a different direction, and that is the work I've been doing with Josh Fu, Jamila Arabachi, a now former MSc student, Matthew Robbins, former PhD student who's now a lecturer at U of Waterloo, Sendiki Surya Macha, and a PhD student of mine, and Magdalena Zeik, who was at Australia, now is in Sweden, on some work we've been doing with quantum superpositions of black holes. And I will get to that in the latter half of the talk. It needs some preliminary discussion. This work, I like to say, is in the context of what's come to be called relativistic quantum information, which you can see from the Venn diagram, attempts to combine our traditional understanding of relativity in the quantum with the concepts of information theory. And so you have quantum information over here and relativistic quantum theory here and so on. The big picture questions that are asked in this kind of discipline, for example, are what is the relationship between information and space-time? How do relativistic effects influence quantum information tasks? Most of quantum information is concerned with non-relativistic physics, and rightly so. That's where the domain typically resides with devices. But nevertheless, the world is relativistic. How do we combine these phenomena to influence things in a matter that perhaps could be exploited? So subfields, for example, are things like relativistic quantum metrology, relativistic quantum communication, and so on. And here, which is mainly the point of what I'm interested in this talk, is how what we might be able to learn about space-time through studying quantum information. So quantum field theory in curved space-time treats both quantum matter fields and gravitation as having equal physical significance. And this subdiscipline, I guess, has been going on for about 50 years. And although I think most of us are aware of some of its flaws, it still, I would say, is close to the best we've got in terms of making computational progress. I think we all hope that this provides clues as to what could be expected from a, quote, true quantum theory of gravity, whatever that might be. And it introduces many issues to deal with, things to do with the causal structure of space-time, black hole entropy, as we heard earlier this morning, the evolution of the cosmos, vacuum entanglement, and what I'm going to talk about here is black hole superposition. So the quantum vacuum is a very different thing from a classical vacuum, and in particular, it tells us that empty space isn't empty. It's filled with fields that are in their ground states, lowest energy states, their vacuum states, electromagnetic fields, scalar fields. We know for sure those two exist, and perhaps others. And these fields, as we learn in introductory quantum field theory, are like a set of coupled springs, one at every point in space-time. So these springs have zero-point energy, if you like, and they vibrate. And the vacuum state, or the ground state, is a global field state where these springs have zero-point energy. So they not only have fluctuations, the fluctuations can be entangled with each other. There's entanglement between these global and local modes. And as noted in these papers, a Bell-like inequality can be violated in principle by these local fluctuations. And as shown in these papers here, Valentini, I think, was the first to, Anthony Valentini was the first to recognize this. In principle, this entanglement can be extracted and put into objects that we can control, devices or detectors, if you like. Benny Resnick rediscovered the effect about 10 years later, I guess 12 years later, in a matter more familiar to theorists. But this notion of entanglement extraction took another several years to really take off and get going, and now there have been lots and lots of studies on it. So what do I mean by a detector? Well, it's a model system that couples to a quantum field, and they're very useful because they allow us to take an operational approach to QFT and curved spacetime, and in fact, even to quantum gravity, somewhat analogous to the way when relativity was constructed. There was a concern with what rods measure, what clocks measure, and how we understand relativity in that viewpoint. So, for example, an electromagnetic field may do whatever it's going to do, but we need atoms to couple to it in order to understand what the electromagnetic field does. If an atom absorbs a photon, we say it jumps up an energy level, and if it emits one, then it drops down a level. And the simplest atom of all, at least from a theorist's viewpoint, is a two-level atom, or what we might call a qubit, or often called an Unruh DeWitt or UDW detector. And basically, it's the simplest atom. It's an atom that has two energy levels, a ground state and an excited state, separated by an energy gap. And so I'll tend to symbolize this in this talk by this little box with two energy levels. It's a bit like a quantum dot. In fact, you might argue that a quantum dot is a kind of UDW detector. And a key quantity of interest is what is the probability in a given situation that this thing will go from ground to excited, for example, or conversely, from excited to ground, depending on the state that it's in. So there's a formalism connected with this. The standard action for the theory is the action of the detector, which is basically it's q dot squared minus omega squared q squared, like a harmonic oscillator, plus the action of the field, plus a term that couples them together. And so if we work, for example, in the context of a cavity, then we can break up the states of the detector into various into this Hamiltonian that has an annihilation operator, a hat, and an excitation operator, a hat dagger. The sub D means detector, and we could have one detector or many, and there's the gap of a given detector. Plus,
this is not a qubit anymore.
This would not be. This would be a harmonic oscillator. That's correct. But if it were a qubit, there would just be a grounded excited state.
Right, so you cannot have an action like that.
That's correct. That's correct. But in the context of the Hamiltonian, yeah. And then there is the, this is the Hamiltonian of the field. And if the detector is moving relative to the field, we're going to get this relativistic dt d tau factor. And then we'll have some interaction Hamiltonian that often is given by this. It linearly couples the field to the detector. And Sheehan Lin and Baylock Hu have spent a lot of time studying this particular model. In a couple of papers that came out at the same time, what I had with Nick Minicucci, Eduardo Martinez, and Eric Brown, wrote out this interaction Hamiltonian explicitly in the context of the of what would happen in a cavity. And the point is that this approach provides an operational means of seeing what quantum fields actually do in a space-time, or I would say more generally, it allows us to actually probe the quantum character of space-time. And what is of a lot of interest here is a two-detector formalism, where we can now place the whole thing in a curved space with this kind of action. And then we would take for the interaction term this two-level raising-lowering operation with sigma plus, sigma minus between ground and excited state. And what we imagine, for example, is that we can isolate the detector from the field for a period. And we, if it were electromagnetism, we could put it in a Faraday cage or something. So we have a switching function. In other words, I imagine these detectors can be made in a factory. And in this factory, it comes with a switcher that here I've modeled with a Gaussian, but there are lots of other models one can make that have only finite time duration. Gaussians are nice because it makes the calculations easier, and they die off very rapidly, so effectively they're only on for finite time. And there are the raising-lowering operators, sigma plus, sigma minus, that I talked about. So if you time-evolve this thing according to the standard unitary prescription, and you obtain a density matrix, and if you trace over the states of the field, because we don't have direct access to the field, we have access to the detector. So we effectively, in all practical circumstances, have to trace over the field, and you end up with a density matrix that looks like this. It's often called an X matrix because that is only diagonal and off-diagonal entries and no entries anywhere else. Now, this is true to order lambda to the fourth, but you can show to any order it retains this X shape. Higher orders introduce a term down in this lower excited part. So there it is again, and these terms in the density matrix are of three types. The first is the P-type term, the probability that the detector gets excited or not, and that, as you can see, depends on the Whiteman function, which is the expectation value of the of phi with phi at x with phi at some other space-time point x prime, and tau is related to the lab time t by the relativistic factor gamma, which may or may not be a function of space and time, depending. It depends both on space-time and on the state of motion of the detector. They're ordered with 0, 0 in the upper left and excited in the lower right. So 0, 0, 0, 0 upper left and EE on the lower right. And then everything else in the middle. So the upper left one means what is the probability that both detectors stay in their ground states to this order in lambda? The probability that both of them become excited is zero to this order, to put the other extreme. So the C term is the term that contains all correlations between the fields. Notice that P basically is a measure of correlation between the state of a detector now and later, whereas C is a correlation of the states between one detector and another, and X has a time ordering property that basically gives us a measure of the non-local correlations that are within the field as transferred to the pair of detectors. This is how detectors know about the structure of the vacuum state of the field, which in turn depends on the structure of space-time. And a key quantity of interest here is something called the concurrence, which is well defined for a pair of qubits and gives us this measure of x minus the root mean square of the detector excitation probabilities. Roughly speaking, this is signal minus noise. And the detectors are going to go clickety-click on their own. What we're interested in is the correlations in the two-qubit case between whether this guy's excited and this not, or vice versa. If the noise is bigger, then the concurrence is zero. But if the noise is smaller, then the detectors will be entangled with each other. So what have we learned from, yeah?
When looking at the structure of this, how can you say that C is local and then X is non-local?
Well, it's all correlations, I guess, technically, local and non-local.
Yeah.
So, but X does not contain the local ones.
Right, but I mean, how can, I'm just looking at these, they look the same to me, right? How can you say minus block on that?
Well, there's a T here, but that's okay. The time ordering.
Okay, I see.
Sorry. So there are two things we've learned from this. One, which was a long time ago, is that accelerated detectors get hot. If you have a detector undergoing uniform acceleration, it was shown a long time ago that it behaves as though it's in a thermal bath whose temperature is proportional to the acceleration with these other constants of nature multiplying the problem. In fact, this was first shown for a quantum field. And my understanding is that after this result came out, there was some controversy in saying, well, the field does this. How are you ever going to know that it actually does it? And this was the rationale for, quote, inventing the theoretical device of the UDW detector to show that the thermality of the field would be transferred to the detector. So in some sense, it's a bit like this. The field is like the weather outside, but the only way to know the temperature of the field is with a thermometer, and the detector is the analog of a thermometer. So a single detector, as I said, behaves as though it's in a heat bath if it's undergoing uniform acceleration. These are highly idealized conditions, but studies over the years have shown that these can be relaxed to finite time accelerations for detectors within cavities to non-uniform motion. The net result is that if you remove the idealized conditions, the accelerating detector does get hot. And that in some that what this teaches us is that a cold vacuum to one observer is a hot vacuum to another observer. And the effect is, as I say, under these conditions, quite robust. And it's been shown a bit fancifully that in principle you could even turn this into a heat engine, though I think, well, nobody's put out a patent on it yet. I don't think it'll be that easy.
And you're calling a hot vacuum isn't a vacuum, is it?
Well, it's not. A hot state, I should say, a hot thermal state. You're quite right. Now, the other result that came out of this is that entangled accelerating detectors have a degradation of entanglement. So suppose you start with a pair of detectors that are entangled, like so, with some coefficients alpha and beta whose squares have to add to unity. If one is accelerated, or in other words, if one of the detectors is carried by an observer undergoing uniform acceleration, then you can show that the entanglement degrades. This is what Yvette Fuentes and I showed about 18 years ago now. That the larger the acceleration, the less the entanglement between the two qubits. And this carries over to fermions. It's been studied now by lots of people. More acceleration means less entanglement. And the reason, I guess before I get to the gravity part, the reason basically is that, or at least the way we understood it, is that there is, from the accelerated detector viewpoint, there's a heat bath. And monogamy of entanglement says that you can't have maximal entanglement of these detectors because the accelerating ones get more and more entangled with the heat bath, and so the original entanglement has to drop.
Sorry, now, Rob, I think I just lost your drift. You have two different detectors entangled with each other, or a superposition of two states of one detector?
The two different detectors entangled with each other. So you have Alice and Bob sharing an entangled state, but Bob, then you ask, what if Bob were a uniformly accelerating observer? What would the entanglement become between them? And then it obeys that graph.
Yeah, so the other thing I didn't follow is, I mean, if you start with a state of a detector, say Bob's, and Bob's accelerating, that won't be a time-independent state. So I don't understand which time you're talking about when you say they'll be less entangled. Do you mean as a function of time, the entanglement will degrade?
No, I'm saying as a function of time, the entanglement is constant. This is a function of acceleration here. So the more acceleration...
Why isn't the state itself time-dependent? Because it's coupled to the field, and so it's interacting and it's changing.
Well, I mean, I'm not quite sure what you mean. If you, what I mean, I suppressed all the slides that show it, but the vacuum state for Bob becomes this whole set of the Rindler thermal vacuum. And the entanglement then between Alice and Bob that was the two-state thing now has to go between all these multiple states, which then get traced over and give this effect.
I think you're saying you want to consider the stationary state that's in equilibrium with the Rindler vacuum.
Yeah, that's right.
You. Is there a physical system that produces an acceleration so you can detect this experiment?
Well, I'll get to that in a minute. Okay. So what also we pointed out is that locally, gravity and acceleration are indistinguishable via the equivalence principle. So this led to the notion and to further studies about gravity affecting quantum entanglement itself. So those are some of the basic results that came out of this. I want to go to now discuss what will end up being the main point of the title is putting detectors in superposition. And Eduardo Yvette and I considered this a number of years ago. The idea was to send a detector through a beam splitter and in one part in a cavity accelerate it and the other part not. And the rationale was to see if this might be a way of getting a handle on the Unruh effect. The problem with the Unruh effect, this relates to your question, John, is that you need enormously large accelerations to see very, very tiny temperatures. So in practice, this is a very difficult thing to measure. But what we pointed out in this paper is that if you accelerate one of the detectors through a cavity and the other one in the bottom, say, is inertial, you end up getting a phase difference at the end between the inertial and the accelerated trajectory, and that phase difference is sensitive to the coupling and to the energy gaps of the detectors here taken to be equal. And this, on this graph, it got cut off, but this is acceleration here in meters per second squared times 10 to the 17, which is still huge, but it was a number of orders of magnitude smaller than what is generally needed for a single detector to go up by a nanokelvin. So this at least was an improvement. And what it showed is that combinations, putting a detector in superposition actually might give you something. So this then a few years later led Magdalena and Josh and Sho Ono to consider what would happen if you just put a UDW detector, a single one, in superposition. How would it respond? And so here again, I have that Hamiltonian I talked about, and the detector excitation probability for either detector, we're only going to have one here. Well, except we have one in superposition. So the idea is the following. You have some quantum superposition of the detector within some other state. Where's that? There we go. State psi 1 or state psi 2. This might be, for example, the detector just being placed in a spatial superposition, for example, or in a superposition of different states of motion. And then, as is common in the quantum optics QI parlance, you couple this to a control qubit so that you can decide. You can then project onto that control bit to see what is measured. For example, in the beam splitter example, you could project onto one path or onto the other, or onto a superposition or combination of paths, depending on whether or not you want which way information. So you then measure in a control state, and then what you find is that the final excitation probability is given by this summation of this product of switchers with the Whiteman function over all the different superpositions. So the detector interferes with itself in this superposed state. and the superposed trajectories exhibit interference. The first thing that we tried was asking, what if you have two detectors and they are in superpositions of acceleration? And you can look at three different kinds: superposed parallel, superposed anti-parallel, or superposed accelerations that have different values. In the first two cases, the magnitudes are the same. In the third case, they are not the same. And what you discover is you don't get an Unruh effect. The detector no longer thinks it is in a thermal bath or experiences a thermal bath. So that was something that I would guess, at least to me, was not a priori obvious.
Why would it not be obvious if the two elements in the superposition sort of are seeing different thermal baths?
Well, except if they have the same acceleration.
I thought you said
the first two have the same acceleration.
But they have different Rindler wedges.
Yes, they have different Rindler wedges. So in hindsight, yeah. But I also would have said the folklore is, whether no matter where the Rindler edge is for one trajectory, it's going to see T as A over 2 pi. Yep. But if the wedges are different, it does not. You're right. And in that sense, I would agree. In hindsight, well, maybe you would have known in advance. But for me, it's only clear in hindsight.
Actually, since we went that far, the last picture, there could be the same wedge.
Sorry, could be?
In the last picture, they could have the same Rindler wedge if their two accelerations were appropriate, had the right ratio.
Well, there they do, and even there they don't come out to be the same.
But that's a contradiction. Because you could go to Euclidean time and then there's one periodicity.
There's one periodicity, but there are two different A's that come out. Sorry.
So it would be like, you know, equilibrium in a gravitational field,
right?
Which I would think would be good enough because it is a global equilibrium state.
Yes. Well, I guess we should discuss afterward, but because I'm not going to get to the end of this if I don't. But all right. So the point is that a superposed detector does gain info about the field, and the this was looked at in a thermal bath, and then later on in De Sitter space, you get these 3D plots. The vertical axis is the response, and the horizontal axis this way is the energy gap of the detector, and this way is the amount of time the detector is left on, if you like, or the switching width as peaked about its central value. So here the superposed detector is separated by a distance L, and a single detector can't distinguish between the thermal bath and, in the De Sitter case, the conformal vacuum of an expanding universe at the same temperature. But if they're superposed, they can tell the difference. So here, as I said at the left, this is the kind of structure you would get for a detector in a heat bath. This is what you would get for a superposed detector in a heat bath. Here's what you would get for a superposed detector in De Sitter space at the same temperature, De Sitter temperature, as the heat bath. And they do distinguish, but if you had a single detector, they would not be able to distinguish the two. Okay, so this led us to consider what we called Schrodinger's cat in De Sitter space. And the idea is the following: superpositions of a stationary detector, of stationary detector trajectories in a single space-time, can be mapped into a situation where you have a single detector in superpositions of diffeomorphic equivalent space-times. So the idea is this: we have the vacuum state, let's say, of De Sitter space, the detector's in the ground state, but it's in a superposition of two different locations, one at location xi, the other at location xi plus L, which can be written in terms of a translation operator like so on a state on the detector at location xi in De Sitter space, ground state, De Sitter vacuum. And when you time evolve this detector in the superposed trajectory, you can then actually, you find that the unitary operator has a xi dependence. So you get u of xi or u of xi plus l because this u hat t hat combines into this unitary operator here. And then you can measure this in a control basis that can be projected onto one or the other trajectory or some combination of both, depending on what you want to do. So this is the notion of the superposed space-time or field. And so the idea pictorially is like this. You have De Sitter space, and let's say the detector on the De Sitter hyperboloid is at one location or at some other location, differs by an angle theta. Then those two unitaries act on the De Sitter vacuum to give us effectively a single detector in what could be regarded as a superposed De Sitter space. Now, these are diffeomorphically equivalent. But when you look at this formalism, you can then say, well, we don't have to do it that way. We could start with this and choose two different De Sitter curvatures, L1 and L2. And this would give us superposed De Sitter space times that are not equivalent in terms of trajectory. So the one on the left, because they're related by a diffeomorphism, this is equivalent to a single De Sitter space where the detectors are in this angular superposition. But the other one is not. This is inequivalent to a single space-time where the detector is in superposition. Yeah?
Question. So De Sitter space is a mixed state because of the temperature. So what is the superposition of mixed state?
You can get them. You just get a density matrix that's, if you like, more mixed.
You just add them? Is that,
yeah.
Can I interject? I don't think global De Sitter is not a mixed state. It's a given static patch would be a mixed state.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
I've got somewhere between 5 and 10, so I want to move on. So here's an example of how the response rate differs between the angular case and the curvature case. And you get, again, with a gap on one axis and the difference in separations on the other axis. So let me, at the end of the talk, get to this notion of black hole superposition. We still lack a quantum theory of gravity, but I think if there is one, it would be very surprising if it did not come with some kind of notion of superposition of space-time. And specifically, what we thought we could do is look at black hole superpositions using this formalism. Now, this is very complicated in general. The curvature isn't constant. The Whiteman functions are mode superpositions. However, there is one class of black holes where you get simplification that allows us to use this formalism, namely constant curvature black holes, the simplest of which is the BTZ type. And the same methods that allowed us to superpose De Sitter space can be applied here. So the idea is we have two superposed detectors. I have a single superposed detector in anti-De Sitter space, and we let it evolve like so, symbolizing ADS, anti-De Sitter space, sorry, by this M.C. Escher-Lobachevsky-type diagram. And so that, using our formalism, can be converted into a single detector that is in a superposed anti-De Sitter space. So anti-De Sitter space, this is well known to lots of people in the audience, can be understood as putting a hyperboloid constraint onto a flat space that has two time directions. And when you do so, you end up with the kind of metric that I show here, which you can actually visualize in a small enough dimension, which I've done on the right. And if you have a conformal scalar coupling, then the Whiteman function is known exactly in terms of the geodesic separation between any two points, x and x prime, where the factor zeta is a boundary condition dependent quantity for the conformally coupled scalar field. You can write this as a sum over modes in higher dimensions, but it's very nice in 2 plus 1 to do that. In fact, you can do this kind of thing in higher dimensions as well. I'm putting this in just to illustrate that you can do it either way. In the case of the BTZ black hole, you have the same kind of covering space metric and constraint surface, but now you do these transformations on these capital X and T coordinates, and you end up instead with this kind of structure, which can be regarded as a Rindlerian version of ADS. And if you then put an identification on phi, you end up with a BTZ black hole, which looks like so. And so what we did is we superposed this using our formalism. In other words, we took two different identifications where the masses were different, analogous to taking two different curvature lengths in the de Sitter case. And we then get this interference type term between the Whiteman functions, where there's the thing about twisted and untwisted boundary conditions. We just considered untwisted, but twisted could be done.
See, you have a single detector in a superposition of two black holes space-time.
Right.
What I'm a little puzzled by is how do you identify where
the detector is?
Yeah, it's like,
it's in two different places. So in one space-time, it's in one place. When the mass gets bigger, it's in the corresponding identical place in the other. But what we're doing is operationally following our noses, so to speak.
The key is corresponding. What is corresponding?
It means that what I do is I take, let's say, space-time A, mass MA, and I'll put the detector at a certain fixed distance. Then I'm going to apply this thing with the transformation operator I had a few slides ago to the whole thing, and I will get black hole B with and the detector will be at whatever the proper distance location is that transformation induces.
Distance from what?
From the horizon. Proper distance from the horizon.
Okay.
Okay, so here's the arithmetic from the formalism, and the interference terms between the two space times give an effective sigma of xx prime between them that looks like this. These m and n are image sums. That's something I didn't say. I guess I got a bit distracted. The Whiteman function for the BTZ case is the ADS case with an image sum given by the identification over phi. And we'll get one image sum here and a different image sum there. And so they combine in all four possibilities, A with A, B with B, A with B, B with A. And so that is what that's what we get. And I guess to address your question, Ted, in the A space time it's at RA, in the B space time it's at RB. So because the masses are different, the energies are different, so we actually have a dynamical evolution of the space times where the energy levels, just the way if you combine superpose an atom at two different energy levels, you get oscillations. So here, you will also get oscillations in the probability. And that's, you can compute via what I've got there on the right-hand side. When you condition on this superposition of masses or of energy levels in atomic physics and trace out the field, you get this kind of situation. You've got ground state, depending on whether you take the plus or minus superposition, and likewise, the probability that the detector will become excited. And if I expand out those two terms, I've color-coded them so you can see which is which. Here is a familiar cos delta E delta T oscillation term that generally comes about when you superpose energy levels. So this would be the time-dependent reduced density matrix of the detector, and the probabilities have to oscillate in time if the detector could indeed be placed in this situation. Here I've got calculations of what the P term is and the alpha and beta terms. The key point when you draw it out are these graphs. We find that if you condition, the blue one is what happens if you condition on MA plus MB, the minus on MA minus B. And here's the bottom diagrams is when you do the same thing, but you've got a phase factor in front of the B black hole. What we find is we get sort of a large scale oscillation in P, punctuated with spikes that happen at integer, at values of the root mass ratio that is like an integer. Where I've written out the formula there for what we find. So this is quite reminiscent of Bekenstein's black hole mass quantization conjecture. In some sense, the detector spikes whenever the mass ratios are in this value. We have ongoing work that this is not published now that looks at this for the rotating BTZ case, which is a whole lot harder than I thought it would be when we started. And we find for the three boundary conditions the same kind of spiking, but now it's at rational values of the horizon radii, R plus B over R plus A, when they're in the same ratio relative to one another. Here the detector is at units, this should be R sub D over L is 3, where L is the ADS length. So again, we get these same kinds of resonant peaks. How could we understand a superposed metric? Well, one way is to understand it as suggested in this paper by Saravani, Eslin, Bigi, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, and Akin Kempf, where the metric is induced by taking this kind of derivative, kind of derivative of the Whiteman function. And so we might say that perhaps the detector, if you saw this response, you could in principle reconstruct whatever the effective superposed black hole metric looked like. So this is my last slide. In summary, what I think we've done is provide an operational way to study and investigate superposed spacetimes, where the detectors themselves, you can place a detector using this formalism in a superposed spacetime and then see how it will respond. It's a way of operationally probing spacetime superposition. We find that in the black hole case, the detector peaks at rational values of the horizon ratio, which is consistent with the Bekenstein conjecture. And so we think this is a promising way for understanding the effects of quantum gravitational phenomena, even though we don't have a quantum theory of gravity. We're just saying if quantum gravity can superpose spacetimes, maybe it'll do something like this. I'll stop there. Thank you.
We're kind of out of time. Is there one quick question? And then we can return to this in the panel discussion this afternoon, because I think there's a lot here. We're not going to get up to all of it. John, quickly?
Two quick questions.
No, one.
We think this was this agitator. We live in a sitter space. Cosmological constant is positive. Can you do this with the sitter?
Well, we did it for pure de Sitter in the earlier slides, yes. And so the answer is yes. To do it for actual structures within De Sitter FRW be a lot harder. What I say harder, what I mean is the formalism of taking this linear combination of unitaries that comes out can be applied. The trouble is calculating the Whiteman functions involves a sum over modes. And I have a recent paper with Qifeng, Chen Zhang, and Yor Maluko, where we actually look at a UDW detector falling into Schwarzschild, no superposition, just a single detector, to see how it would respond. Everybody says it's supposed to have a standard bland response. We find it's almost like that, but not quite. But it's a horrible sum over modes. Computationally, it's very intensive. And maybe a genius in computer science could make it a lot more efficient than we were able to. But that's the key technical barrier. So the reason for focusing on this kind of idealization is it's the standard hope that it's simple enough to calculate, but the basic structure of Horizon provides insight. But sure, I would love to do what you say in more generality.